those with dirty cold to go, been cold since cold flow. Got a wire to enlarge and I set a fire down below. I hang it up when you say sorry, didn't know. Probably got a year, 10 to go, so let's go. I don't really know how to go slow.
Welcome, listeners, to another wonderful episode brought to you by us, the Anti-Racist Educator. My name's Hashim. I am joined today by my co-member of the collective, Naveen. And we're welcoming all the way from California, the esteemed critical theorist and professor of revolutionary critical pedagogy, Peter McLaren. Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Good. And how are you, Naveen, here in Glasgow?
Oh, doing well and excited for this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's going to be so great. I've been excited for weeks and weeks that it's been in the making. And going to chat with you, Peter, and Naveen. Naveen is a lot of your work revolves around critical literacy, so it links in quite well with our chat today about critical pedagogy. To chat with Peter about his experiences as an educator and what role critical pedagogy can play in education and the world at large today. I think the chat will go towards meeting one of the goals we have as a collective, which is to raise critical consciousness of race, but in this podcast, draw attention to that wider matrix of power relations that we're all subject to. So yeah, thank you so much again, Peter. Let's just start off with that point that I raised in the introduction there. Could you tell us a bit about your own journey as a teacher and maybe how these experiences have shaped your activism and research?
That's great. I'd be happy to do that. Well, let me see. I was born just after the Second World War in 1948 in Toronto, Canada. So I grew up in Toronto, in Winnipeg, and then actually came to the U.S. in 1985. I was recruited by a critical theorist named Henri Giroux. To come and work with him at a university called Miami of Ohio. But prior to that, I had taught, and this was, I guess, the 1970s, I taught grades 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And I started out actually teaching grades 7 and 8 in a middle school in a very wealthy village outside of Toronto. I think that it was called Unionville. And it was an interesting experience. I think I was okay as a teacher. I had a lot to learn. These are my first year of teaching. And I realized, having read some articles and done a little bit of research, that the students that I was teaching in this wealthy village were going, and I think they liked me okay. I think I did a pretty good job. I'd probably rate myself C+. But I realized that they would probably do just as well, despite whatever teacher they had, because of the socioeconomic status, because of the class positionality of their families. And then it became fairly clear to me that the greatest, and this was over time, it became clearer and clearer, that the greatest predictor of academic success was not how creative you were, not how industrious you might be, but in fact, the socioeconomic status of your family and in the community at large. So I decided at that point that I wanted a stronger challenge. And that led me to a job teaching grade 2 and 3 and 4, 5 and 6 at a public school in an area of Toronto called the Jane Finch Corridor, which was considered in the popular press to be the most dangerous area in all of Canada. That was how the press hyped it. And there were a lot of immigrants, new immigrants from all over the world. There was a large Jamaican community, and there were poor whites from Eastern Canada. There were about 35 different languages spoken in that community. And so I managed to get a job there, and very few teachers really wanted to work in that area. Again, this was in the 1970s. And I had a good relationship with the principal, who became a mentor of mine. He was called the hugging principal. I remember that. When I was there, he took a sledgehammer one day, walked down the corridor of the school, smashed down the wall to his office, cleared out all the bricks and mortar, and he put a rocking chair in place of his steel desk, and he took that away, and he put a little pine table and a rocking chair. And students from all over the school would come and get a hug from him. He'd give them a hug, and he was called the hugging principal. And he'd just give them a hug and just talk to them a little bit. And this was quite remarkable. And he sort of saw me. He told me, he said, "Peter, I think you're a lot like me when I was young." And of course, I'm in my 70s now, but at that point, I really took that as an incredible compliment. And so what I did was I took out all the furniture in my, I was teaching, by the way, in a portable, you know, a little sort of a little building, prefabricated building outside of the main school. And I just took all the furniture out, and I went and into the rich areas, you know, during garbage day, and retrieved some cushions and pillows and, you know, and comfortable pieces of furniture, put them in there, and found a set of secondhand drums. And the students and I just drummed for, I guess about a month. All we did was just play drums. And their test scores, of course, shot up incredibly. They really improved in so many different areas. And I don't really have an explanation as to why that. I've never really wrote about that, about why they seem to succeed well. So I taught there and kept a diary of my experiences, because things were pretty rough. I mean, we had snipers that shot at us from the balconies in the nearby public housing projects. They weren't trying to hit us. They were just trying to blow the windows out from the school during recess. And of course, that was pretty dangerous practice. There were students that had parents that would come to the school with trained attack dogs to attack the teachers who felt that their children were being abused by the teachers. So there were a lot of episodes that I put down in my diary, and I wanted to publish my diary because I thought that this would sort of help alert the Canadian public, you know, to what was happening in communities like the Jane Finch Corridor that were, you know, that the schools basically were not meeting the needs of new immigrants to Canada. And I think I was well-intentioned, but as I'm about to tell you, I really regretted writing that book, although that book basically started a path for me towards critical pedagogy. So basically, I put the diary together. This was after about 5 years of writing down things that were occurring in the classroom, things that I witnessed firsthand. Some of the diary excerpts were heart-rending, and some were humorous, but many emphasized the kind of violence that was occurring in and around the school. And so the book came out. Actually, I always wanted to be a writer, and so that was an exciting part of this journey. The book, I found a literary agent. The book came out. It was number 7 bestseller in Canada. And I was elated. I thought, wow, I've really done something to sort of help, you know, help these young people in places like the Jane Finch Corridor. And then I began to read the reviews that came out in local newspapers, etc. And they sometimes were accompanied by cartoons. And they would have me, the sort of white kind of hero, and they would have these students portrayed as kind of monsters. And the reviews were, how did Peter McLaren survive teaching in the Jane Finch Corridor? You know, how did this young man, how was he able to handle working with these sort of unruly students? And I began to become quite alarmed at how people were reading the book. And then I went to a conference, a big meeting that was organized by the Board of Education and the Social Planning Council. And somebody gave me a tip-off as to what was going to occur. I was one of the featured speakers, and I was going to defend my book. You know, the community was coming in. This was at a place called Yorkwood's Library. But 500 members of the community would be present. And I was told to be careful that after the meeting, that there was a group that were going to break my legs with a baseball bat. Of course, that didn't happen. But I went to the meeting a little bit nervous. And I stood on the stage with a microphone, and I began to attempt to defend why I had written this book. And I remember one of the leaders of the West Indian communities, a middle-aged woman, stepped up on stage, interrupted my talk, and reached out to grab the microphone, and I handed it to her. And she looked at me and she said, "Peter, we loved you as a teacher. You were one of our best teachers. You broke bread with us in our homes. You visited members of our family in prison. You would play floor hockey with our children after school, and we know that you had a family of your own, and you lived a couple of hours away, and you came in every day early in the morning and left, in the early evening. And we loved you for that. So why did you write this book? Why did you demonize our community? And why did you make, you know, our students look like, you know, monsters?" And of course, at that time, I was on the defensive. I just gave a typical liberal response that I was just trying to alert, you know, Canadians to the needs of young people that weren't being met. And one of the reasons the book came out as it did, and I'm not offering this as an excuse, but I remember talking to the editor, and I had been reading a little bit of sociology at the time, not much. Now, I was just a young teacher at that time, but I was attempting to educate myself around issues about schooling and democracy and justice and equality. And I had a little bit in the draft of the book that tried to account for the relationship between poverty and violence. But the editor looked at me and said, "Peter, you have a bestseller. And if you start, you know, putting sociology theories in your book, we're not going to be able to market it as a trade book. Let the people make up their own minds about what they're reading. Let the events speak for themselves." Now, at that point in time, I thought, okay, let the events speak for themselves. Later on, I learned that nothing ever speaks for itself. Everything speaks in a context, and those contexts have to be fleshed out. But at the time, it sounded fine. And so the book got published with no explanatory framework, with no kind of reflection or deep reflection or deep theoretical reflection, or there was little self-reflexivity in the book. And you know, I was becoming really nervous about this book being very popular. I was almost tempted at that time to go into the libraries and hide the book so no one would read it. But then I took a leave of absence from teaching, And I was told by the head of the Department of Education that I would never be put in an inner city school again. And they were gonna, if I came back to teach, they'd put me away in a rural area someplace where I couldn't do harm. But I remember I was accepted into a PhD program at the Ontario Institute for Studies in New Education, which was at the time one of the top education institutes in the world, actually. And I was really delighted that I'd been accepted. But I remember driving to my first day of classes. I had the radio on and I'm driving down Yonge Street, which is the main drag. And I was listening to a radio show. And on the radio, it was a kind of a talk show, not unlike this one. And but they were interviewing a white supremacist. They were interviewing, you know, Canada has a lot of this. You know, it was kind of like the Ku Klux Klan Canadian version. And they were interviewing this guy, and the interviewer, of course, was giving this guy a hard time and challenging him. But at the very end, the interviewer said, "Okay, well, of course, I'm glad most Canadians would not agree with you, but thank you for being on the show and expressing your opinion." He said, wait. He said, "Can you give me a few more seconds?" And he said, "Okay, half a minute, and then we have to close down the show." And the guy said, "I want to tell all you Canadians that are listening to buy a book called Christ in the Corridor by Peter McLaren." And the interviewer interrupted him and said, "Well, wait a second. Why would you recommend that book by Peter McLaren? It would seem that Peter McLaren would have a very different viewpoint than you." And he said, "Well, that might be true, but when you see how all these dark-skinned students are coming into the country from all these different countries, you want to change the immigration laws and keep them out." And I drove the car off the road, almost went through the windshield. I put the brakes on and I start to tremble. And that's when I began to realize that I hadn't really given much thought and I needed to be re-educated. I began to realize that I was coming into this whole teaching situation with this idea that I was some kind of, you know, savior of these kids. And I really didn't question issues around race. I had a little bit of knowledge around class. And so that was my initiation. The book was a resounding success. I came across as sort of a liberal, good, well-intentioned, liberal white guy. And that's when I began to read the work of Paulo Freire. And Paulo Freire went on to become one of my teachers and one of my friends. And things took off after that. But that was my early experience. So I learned, you know, I learned from that experience.
Wow, Peter. I have to say that is quite a journey. Because I think right now, me personally, I'm a primary teacher here in Scotland, and I can kind of see in my own experience some of the things that you were talking about how some of the context is just ripped out of the places in which we teach. And as you say there, it can be like instrumentalized by really terrible people. It's like really terrible ends if we just provide a kind of colorblind, context-free account of things. And also you just talk, and it's just, I love the way you chat. It's just so smooth and like relaxing. And even when you're talking about a sniper shooting at a window,
yeah.
It's wild. Thank you so much. So then kind of like jumping off from that, you're talking about taking first steps into critical pedagogy. I think for me and a lot of our listeners, this might be a kind of initial an initial contact with critical pedagogy. and that it's not a huge part of, maybe Naveen, you can correct me, of lots of programs for teacher education. It wasn't a huge part of mine. So could you be able to like trace some of those roots of critical pedagogy and how it might differ from other predominant approaches to teaching? And it would be great to hear about the time you spent with Paulo Freire as well in that.
Yeah, well, I'd love to do that. Just to backtrack a little bit, I had a counterpoint to work through, and I didn't really work through it when I was, you know, writing my book, my first book, my first of 53 books. I can't believe that. And that counterpoint was a trip I took in 1968 to the States. And in 1968, if I could just reason I'm going back to 68 should become clearer.
Please, thanks.
If I could do that. But I went to the States, I hitchhiked to the States. In those days you could hitchhike without much trouble. And that was, 68. So Malcolm X was assassinated, I think, 65. So that was about 3 years after Malcolm X's assassination. I was in the States for mostly the spring and summer and early fall. While I was down there, Bobby Kennedy, I remember, was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. I think Martin Luther King was assassinated in April and Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June. So a lot of things were going on. And when I was down there, I met, you know, some of the Black Panthers. And I remember I was on a bus, a Greyhound bus. I didn't hitchhike the whole way. I took a Greyhound bus when I could. And I remember on a Greyhound bus, a Black woman was reading The Diary of Malcolm X and introduced me to that book. And that was quite an experience. And I ended up, of course, doing what hippies did in those days. I ended up actually spending time with Timothy Leary, who was the high prophet of LSD. He was fired from Harvard University and I guess was maybe one of the most famous figures in the world at that time. I met him at the Audubon Ballroom and during a concert. And at that time he introduced me to, you know, LSD and I was doing the whole hippie experience. Met Allen Ginsberg, who gave me a lot of, the poet Allen Ginsberg, who gave me a lot of confidence when he read my work and commented on my writing. So I'd come back, you see, from this experience, trying to make sense of it. And I did have a sense of looking at myself as, you know, a white male. That was sort of birthing inside of me at that particular time. So I did have that counterpoint of, you know, the kind of the 60s revolution. That was an incredible time in 1968. You know, there were revolutions going on all around the world, in Paris, you know, and in the streets of many different streets and cities throughout the US. And so I did have that sort of as the counterpoint. Now, critical pedagogy is interesting because I had the same experience that you had in my, education in my PhD program. We didn't deal with it at all. And once a professor of mine came in and gave us an article that was outside of the syllabus, and I really loved this article, and the article actually was by Henry Giroux. And I started reading it, and then I started reading, you know, the list of authors that he had cited. And I started to sort of educate myself. And I became very angry that this, you know, this work, which was called radical pedagogy at that time, I became very, very disappointed that it wasn't, you know, a more centrally located in the curriculum in my PhD program. Now, in 1985, oh, by the way, I should say this, yes, I started reading Paulo's work, not having met him at that time. I started reading the work of Paulo Freire. I got a job in the university, Brock University. I was hired as a sabbatical replacement. One of the professors had run off a computer program, had duplicated it, and it was, at that time, it was, you know, patented, and the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, arrested him, and he had a nervous breakdown, so there was a job opening, and I took that job, and I was teaching, I think it was psychometric approaches to reading. And by that time, I was just, you know, raring to go politically. And I was attempting to teach critically. I was trying to create in my classes what I would call a psychosocial moratorium, in which we tried to create spaces of liminality. In other words, we tried to sort of break down the hierarchies that we identified. And so, you know, I became one of the students along with them, and I was trying to experiment. And at the end of the year, I'd heard that there were a bunch of students that appeared on campus that were protesting me and wanted me to be fired because they felt my classes were overly politicized. And then there was a larger group of students that appeared on campus and did a counter protest, saying that they wanted to keep me because they found my classes really exciting and important to them. And the dean called me in at the end of the final semester and said, well, I did promise I'd rehire you again. You were on a one-year contract. I did promise that you'd come back. But if you've caused all this trouble in your first year as a professor, I can only imagine what's to follow. So you're out of here. And so I had my PhD in hand. I had 1 year experience, and I was unemployed. And then something really interesting happened. I had done a dissertation on ritual, schooling as a ritual. And I had studied a Catholic school. That was my PhD dissertation, going into a Catholic school and looking at the rituals. And looking, in other words, conceiving a lot of the interaction between among and between teachers and students as rituals. And I had a pretty strong command of the literature on ritual. I was reading anthropological works like you wouldn't believe. And somebody, unbeknownst to me, a friend of mine actually, Anthony Wilden, took a copy of my dissertation and dropped it off at a publisher in London, England called Routledge. And at that time, you know, Routledge was one of the, you know, top education publishers you could imagine. And I got a telegram from Routledge saying, you know, Basil Bernstein has read your work and thinks it's, you know, decades ahead of its time, and please don't take it anywhere. We want to publish it as a book. And I thought this was maybe some kind of prank. And because I had no idea my friend had dropped this off on the desk of Routledge Publishers. And I got this telegram. It was legit. And I thought, well, my goodness, I'm unemployed. Routledge is going to be publishing my dissertation. How can I take advantage of this? So I thought, well, I'll get somebody very famous to write an introduction. And so I contacted Henry Giroux, on the phone, and he agreed to write the introduction. And then he said, Peter, let's work together. And we'll build a cultural studies center. We'll have the first cultural studies center in schools of education in the United States. Come and create the center with me. And so he had been fired, Henry, by John Silber, the president of Boston University. Silber tried to fire Howard Zinn, probably the greatest historian in U.S. history, but Zinn already had tenure, but Henry didn't have tenure. So Henry had been fired by John Silber for his work in critical pedagogy, and Henry ended up at a place called Miami of Ohio. And so Henry, you know, said, come to Miami of Ohio. We'll probably be the only two, you know, radical leftists in the school, but come on and join me. And he did. He was good on his word, and he helped me get my first position. And that required me to move to the United States. And so I think I moved in 1985, and that was the year I met Paulo Freire. I met Paulo Freire because Paulo was a good friend of Henry. As a matter of fact, whenever Paulo was visiting Henry, there'd always be an unmarked car, an unmarked sedan sitting outside of Henry's home, and we figured that was probably CIA or FBI. But so I met Paulo Freire at a conference in 1985, and things just took off from that, because by that time I'd been reading and publishing quite a bit. And I remember at one point Paulo telling me that he really liked my work, and I was shocked that he would even know about my work. And he wrote a preface to one of my books. I think the book was called Predatory Culture, where he talked about the affinity that we both shared for social justice. And he was such a generous man. I just, you know, I was just stunned that he would take an interest in what I was doing. And that started a relationship until his death. I managed to spend some time with Paulo in Brazil. And Paulo's work, it really has become iconic. And I remember being asked by Routledge, actually, in England. I remember being asked by a group of editors whether or not a book about Paulo Freire's work would have any relevance for, you know, the moment. And I said, absolutely. I said, his work is really taking off in the US, and I think that a book coming out in the UK that could be distributed to the US would just be really important. And so I published a book called Paulo Freire, A Critical Encounter, and then several other books about Paulo's work after that. Now, back in 2005, even, Hugo Chavez from Venezuela, when I was working in Venezuela for the Bolivarian Revolution, and the idea was to make education a little bit more Freirean for the revolution there. And so Freire's work, I mean, was just taken up in so many different countries, in so many different situations, that whenever progressive educators want to have a conversation in common, it usually begins by a discussion of the work of Paulo Freire. Now, you know, Freire was you know, he was imprisoned for 70 days. He spent time in Bolivia, Chile. He actually had a position, I think it was in 1968 in Harvard University. His work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is really, you know, it's a masterpiece that links critical education all over the world. Now, unfortunately, you know, the right, I wouldn't say the right, I'd say sort of the center liberal left has done a lot to domesticate Freddie's work. So, you know, people take what they want from Freddie. For some people, sitting with your students in a circle, talking about current events, that to them is representative of critical pedagogy. And this domestication of the politics underlying Freddie's work has been of some concern to me. And so I came up with a new term. Actually, I borrowed the term from a British educator, Paula Allman, called revolutionary critical pedagogy, in order to distinguish the more domesticated versions of Freddie from the more radical Marxist versions of Freddie. I had been, you know, writing as a critical postmodernist in the 1980s for a number of years, until I had a conversation with an educator from Brighton in England. We had been invited to Germany and to a conference in Germany, and he had a conversation with me and talked about returning to Marx. And we had a long discussion about the importance and relevance of Marx's work. And that shifted me from this sort of postmodernist culturist approach to critical pedagogy to a more Marxist-driven critical pedagogy. And so I've been writing under sort of the umbrella of revolutionary critical pedagogy, then, to mark that distinction. Of course, my work has been sort of inspired by critical race theory, of course, critical race theory, and the work of Franz Fanon, the work of the Marxist humanist Raya Donaevskaya, and I think there's at least a moment where this kind of work is speaking to a lot more people, because we're at a historical inflection point right now. There have been three crises that have intersected. One is overaccumulation, right? The crisis in capitalism, the crisis of overaccumulation. That's been with us for decades. We got the coronavirus pandemic, and we've got the Black Lives Matter movement. Protests are still happening on a daily basis here in the United States, and have been for months since the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police. So this crisis has led to the rise of, I think, a new generation of anti-racist activists, not only in the U.S., but of course in many other countries throughout the world, you know, challenging political repression, challenging the steady erosion of the rule of law, the police abuse, taking on the criminal justice system, systemic racism, and social inequality. And so I think that these three intersecting crises has provided an important historical opportunity for revolutionary critical pedagogy to become more dominant within the educational system. And I think, you know, that these crises have undressed capitalism to a certain extent and have shown and revealed our vulnerability. You know, I think that the socioeconomic impacts of this coronavirus pandemic will likely unfold for years and years and perhaps even decades to come. And I think we're at this historical inflection point right now where revolutionary critical pedagogy can really, I think the door is now opening wider and wider for people to understand the importance of this approach. And again, it's not my approach. It's an approach that intersects with the work of many, many, many critical educators around the world. I'm just happy to be able to be part of this struggle.
Wow. I mean, it's, yeah. There's like such stories that you tell, Peter, that really kind of give like a good something to hold on to when you talk about these like quite complicated big topics. Like hearing your experiences like really makes it a lot more clear. So yeah, that's great. But yeah.
Well, I want you to say, I think that the storytelling is really interesting in that I think there's a lot of the big concepts that, you know, that we talk about or that we read about in some of the like the theoretical work that we're experiencing through these everyday moments and the stories or the lived experiences that we actually have. And a lot of that is coming through in the kinds of stories that you're telling us. You know, like those relationships of power that you've been navigating and the kind of self-realization or the realization of how our own actions and ways of doing things and ways of being have these social effects and can be read and need to be read in context as well. So I think there's a lot from your own stories that tell us a lot about how critical pedagogy might work and how we can learn to embody it in different ways.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we're at a point here in the United States where there's been a big push for schools to reopen amidst the coronavirus pandemic. And we have, you know, the most dangerous man on the planet is our president. There's no question about that. Probably the most dangerous leader in history. And I say that in concert with Noam Chomsky, who makes the claim that, you know, Trump's pulling back from the Paris Climate Accord and all of Trump's, you know, all the measures that Trump has taken to destroy environmental protections has placed the world in peril. And of course, you know, the pulling out of the accord with Iran and all these things have made the world much more dangerous to nuclear annihilation. We have a president that is pushing young people to go back to school without really taking responsibility, without a plan. You know, our Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, comes from a family of billionaires. Her brother, Eric Prince, was the head of Blackwater, which was a private mercenary company. And he's changed the name. I forget what the name is now because of all the black publicity that his company was getting. I think he now provides private military mercenary services to other countries as well. And, you know, you've got the brother, Eric Prince, you've got Betsy DeVos, whose goal, she's been quoted as saying that, you know, her goal of of education should be, you know, realizing Jesus's kingdom or something like that. And she's funneling all these public funds for schools to religious schools. Now, you know, I come from a liberation theology Catholic background, right? Social gospel background, and I have no problem with religion, but when Trump is actually tweeting the work of Dr. Stella Emanuel, in terms of her views on the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, we have to sort of take pause. I don't know if you've read about that in Scotland, but this doctor is a practicing primary care physician in Houston, and she's a member of the group called America's Frontline Doctors, and who advocate the use of hydroxychloroquine as a cure for COVID-19. But she made headlines recently and was supported by Trump. She's also the founder of Firepower Ministries and describes herself as God's battle axe and weapon of war. And she believes that coronavirus, COVID-19 rather, is caused by us demons having sex with you at night. she believes, you know, that vaccines are made with alien DNA. So she claims that the coronavirus is really a demon seed. She claims that endometriosis, cysts, infertility, impotence are the result of humans having sex with spirit husbands and spirit wives and all this kind of crazy stuff. But Trump will actually, you know, tweet her to his followers. And he's got, 45 million followers on Twitter. So we've had this, and we've got this real insanity happening in this country. And I've been trying to deal with that by writing a series of editorials and articles about just the utter lunacy of the political scene right here. But it, you know, as much as we might want to laugh at it and consider it sort of an updated Monty Python, right? Show. It does have incredibly serious consequences. Now, Trump is hiding the fact that, you know, the U.S. is a far higher rates of coronavirus infections and death than many other countries by citing the proportion of patients who die who already have the coronavirus. And so the percentage of people who die as a proportion of the public is the important statistic, okay? The number of deaths per capita, not the proportion who die as a share of patients, as Trump would like to have it. So, Trump is just, he's just conning the country, and it's a frustrating place to be right now.
Mm-hmm. And in light of this, like, really real, and as you've like described so well, with respect to these people that Trump has been retweeting and publicly showing support for, in the face of this like very like existential threat to the lives of the most marginalized people in the world, as we can see through the protest movements that have sprung up all across the states and across different parts of the world in reaction to this injustice. A lot of people, I think, generally say the line that comes out is that we need to have education on it. You can see it when it comes to like racism in the UK. A lot of the times people have been like, okay, how do we fight against racism? People will say, we need to start in schools and in education. But it's always a kind of value-free preach to to that. There's always, there's no kind of, I don't know, conditions attached to that hark towards education being like the thing that will cure all our ills. And like being a teacher, I can kind of see like the contradictions in that, and that schools are a large part of the problem and uphold a lot of these inequalities. So I guess we can, we could finish off with kind of maybe a little bit from yourself on how embracing critical pedagogies can help us navigate the destruction really that we're facing all around us. What do you think that the role it has, and how might we go about actually realizing that?
Every human being, every young person, every old person has the right to ask the question, what is society made of me that I no longer want to be? And that's something that, you know, Henri Giroux talks a great deal about. What is society made of me that I no longer want to be? And so for me, the question, and if every student has a right to ask that question, then we need to address the question of how students are formed. How are they educated? What is the process of their own formation as social agents of change? And it's very difficult when we live in a society that's becoming more and more misanthropic. You know, a misanthrope is a pessimist, but is more than a pessimist. A misanthrope is someone who hates humanity to the core, who lacks trust, who feels what, besieged by others who are trying to take advantage of him or her, or who suffers from a negative and social atomism, who lacks faith in human nature. We live in this misanthropic society. But, you know, misanthropy usually has a companion, and that companion is mythology. Mythology is the hatred of reason. And this hatred of reason, of course, emerged from the counter-enlightenment. But I think combined with this rampant anti-intellectualism in the US makes for a society filled with conspiracy theories and chaos. And so it's very important, I think, to have a better pedagogical approach that helps students reason dialectically and helps students understand their own formation and builds what I call their protagonistic agency, their social agency. So the question, for instance, that gets asked in a lot of, you know, people that are interested in identity politics, very often the question is, you know, who am I, right? Who am I? And of course, that's an important question, but that presupposes an epistemological response. Who am I? Well, that depends, you know, on all these different contexts. And, you know, we spend hours and hours in sociology seminar debates talking about identity and who we are, et cetera, et cetera. It's not unimportant, but I think critical pedagogy poses a question prior to the question, who I am. And that question is, where are you? Where do you stand? Because the question, where do you stand, presupposes not an epistemological response, but an ethical response. So for me, ethics always precedes epistemology and critical pedagogy. In other words, you know, where do you stand? I think the question is, I stand here. Here is where I stand, and I'm standing here with you. I'm not standing here for you. You can speak for yourself. People can speak for themselves. Obviously, I'm you know, not here to speak for others, but I'm standing alongside others in support. So I think we begin to ask this question, and it has an ethical emphasis. So for me, that's like in liberation theology, an important, I guess you could say, direction. And the direction is called a preferential option for the poor, the oppressed, the immiserated, and for those that are suffering needlessly in this capitalist system that we're all trapped in. Now, I take that a little bit further. I don't call it a preferential option. I call it a preferential obligation. So we have an obligation, and that comes from an ethical orientation. That comes from, it's not necessarily a religious orientation, because I found that, you know, very often atheists make the best Christians, for instance, and from my own orientation. So you begin with an ethical obligation, and then you can go on and talk about identity and the importance of identity. But I have in my work looked at the question of critical multiculturalism, and that was something that I was very interested in back in the early 1990s. I started writing about whiteness. I had articles out called White Terror, the importance of abolishing whiteness. And of course, the Ku Klux Klan got very mad at me when I went down there and gave a talk called The Abolition of Whiteness in Georgia. I almost ran me out of town. But I started, looking at the issue of multiculturalism as part and parcel of critical pedagogy. It's foundational to critical pedagogy is critical multiculturalism. And for me, I came up with a topology. It's very, very simple. And one is that there's conservative multiculturalism, there's liberal multiculturalism, left liberal multiculturalism, and critical multiculturalism. Now, conservative multiculturalism, is very much concerned with, how can we understand other cultures? How can we know, for instance, if we're going to go and make a financial deal in Japan, we want to know about proxemics. We want to know about, how close should I stand to the person who I'm negotiating with? And it's all run by capital. It's run by profits. Conservative corporate multiculturalism. They want to understand difference for the, because they want to augment their own profits and their businesses. Liberal multiculturalism is concerned with sameness. A teacher in a playground would say something like, I saw Levon and Billy fighting in the playground, but I didn't notice that Levon was African American and Billy was white. I just saw Levon, and Billy. And there's this sense of, of sameness. If you cut me, my blood is red. If you cut, Levon, Levon's blood is red. And there's a sense of, colorblindness. And of course, you can't be colorblind until you're first of all color conscious. Now, left liberal multiculturalism stresses more, you get teachers that sort of put more emphasis on difference. So for instance, if you gave a questionnaire, and this has been done, I've read studies where they've given questionnaires, this would be back in the 1990s, to white women and African-American women. An African-American woman, the question would be, how do you define yourself? Who are you? How do you define yourself? African-American women always emphasize, I'm black. I'm a black woman. I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm an aunt, I'm a teacher. But I'm black. There's this emphasis on difference. Whereas the white women would very often not refer to themselves as white. They would just say, I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm a teacher, etc. Because at that particular moment, the white women felt somehow that they were sort of the universal embodiment, right, of what being a woman is, of course. And of course, there you can see the problems with all three positions, or some of the limitations, not problems, some of the limitations. Critical multiculturalism begins to interrogate the whole concept of difference. How was difference created historically? How was it created in terms of the social forces of production, the economy, for instance? How are racism and capitalism, in mutually generative? How do they reinforce each other? How are they mutually constitutive? And so for me, that's the key. The key is to move towards a critical multiculturalism, which interrogates the whole meaning of how difference, right, came to be historically. Because if you look at the history of whiteness in the United States, you have to go back to, say, Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. This was an important historical moment when people began really to talk, to make a difference between, you know, describing somebody as white or as non-white. Nathaniel Bacon was a wealthy white property owner. He came in Virginia, and he came into conflict with William Berkeley, who was the governor of Virginia. And so they had this disagreement. I won't get into that. But to move on very quickly, Bacon organized his own militia, and his militia, because he was going to fight Berkeley. And Bacon's militia consisted of white and black indentured servants, enslaved black people, and they began to create a power struggle with Bacon and his militia on one side and Berkeley, you know, who was basically the head of the plantocracy on the other side. And so, you know, Berkeley was terrified that there was this multiracial alliance of indentured servants. Of course, indentured servants would be white people from, say, the UK, right? Or from England at that time, and slaves. So, you know, you had white people, white Europeans, Anglo-Americans, and African slaves fighting together against the plantocracy. And so, you know, Berkeley said, well, what can we do to prevent this? Well, let's make legal distinctions between white and black. So let's permanently enslave Virginians of African descent, and let's give these poor white indentured servants from Europe, let's give them some new rights, and let's give them a new status. And so this kind of worked. It was sort of divide and rule. And then you began to read in documents, historical documents, that you know, somebody would be referred to as white. Before that, in most cases, if you were from England, you were English. If you were from Germany, you were German. They didn't use the term white. So this was a historical moment when whiteness as an identity formation was invented. The invention of the white race. And so we look at this historically. And that's part, I think, of what critical multiculturalism attempts to accomplish. Did that make sense?
Yeah, I actually just tried to, I did eventually finish The Invention of the White Race, the book by Theodore Allen. And what you just said there makes so much sense and gives a kind of nice summing up of the book. And the things that you talk about in terms of these, the positions that we inhabit, subjectivities that we have, are not like inevitable in any way. They're kind of, they're made in history and in culture. And as you talk about, like, there's large forces of capitalism at play that we need to like pay attention to. It's really, really essential. So thank you so much, Peter. I could have listened to you all night. It's getting dark here, but we could have kept on going on for longer. Naveen, how is it for you?
Oh, it's brilliant. I do want to say thank you. I mean, like Ashim said, you know, ITE can find it very easy to leave critical pedagogy out, or you know, it's an elective course or program, and so, you know, so a lot of the work being done now is to integrate this into the mainstream practices of teaching and learning in teacher education. And myself, as someone interested in critical literacies, it's this, you know, how we read the world, and, you know, so and this recognition that of like, yes, we speak discourses, but discourses speak us, and engaging with that as a mainstream everyday practice of being critical is it's kind of pertinent. So both your stories and your explanations of critical pedagogy and these like varying sorts of multiculturalism are exceptionally revealing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Yes, you know, I think the work though is that I've been doing seems to be taken up more in Latin America actually than it is in North America. I have an institute in Mexico where we work with teachers, and we bring in radical professors from all over Latin America to come in and teach and work with the teachers there. It's so that's exciting too. It's interesting because I can get a sense of, you know, geopolitically of where, you know, the critical pedagogy or revolutionary critical pedagogy is being taken up. So it's being taken up with a lot more, you know, fervor in a much more robust way in Latin America. But it's still, you know, it's growing, and I think it's growing among young people now. There's what we call ethnic studies now, which is being made compulsory in some of the school boards in California. Now, ethnic studies might sound pretty, you know, old school. But it's really it really came out of the Chicano movement, and Mexican Americans and their struggles and their the fight really against colonialism. So if you look at critical pedagogy now, what are the key things that people are looking at? They're looking at indigeneity. They're looking at what's called mestizaje, which is a kind of mixture of, you know, indigenous, you know, being indigenous and being European, you know, a sort of mixture, mestizaje. And they're looking at, all kinds of issues around what's called the patrón de poder colonial, the coloniality of power, you know. And so they're really, and, you know, we're looking at, we've got, you know, critical race theory, we've got Lat Crit, which is Latino Crit. So we've got, you know, feminist, you know, critical pedagogy, which is fantastic. You know, womanist critical pedagogy. And so critical pedagogy, which is interesting, has made its way through different disciplines. So where did I get my recent invitation to do an interview? That was in a Griffith University law school, in a law school journal. And they wanted to, they did like this massive interview with me, and I'm thinking, my goodness, so there's an interest in law schools, in Australia, at least, in critical pedagogy. Because critical race theory came out of critical legal studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all like intimately linked. And I think, like, I was just saying to Naveen before you came on, before my teacher training, I would spend a lot of time reading yours and Henry Giroux's work. And that was kind of my first like contacts with critical pedagogy. And then when the demands of teacher training and then life of being a teacher took over, that kind of reading just kind of fell by the wayside. It was so easy to kind of forget all of those, you know, critical insights that we've like had the pleasure to like listen to tonight from you, and also reflect me and Naveen ourselves about like our journeys through education. That it's just really great to chat and have that real life exposure to you and your stories and your work. So thank you again. Peter, it was an absolute pleasure. People in Scotland might be asking for you to open up a centre here also. I know I would definitely want it. We welcome you back anytime. Thank you so much to all of our listeners. Just as Peter was saying about the Chicano movement, we're actually hopefully going to be chatting to Curtis Acosta, who's one of the pioneers in the Chicano movement and was in a film called Precious Knowledge, which focuses on a high school protest to kind of enshrine that in their curriculum. And we'll talk more about that when that comes on.
That video, Precious Knowledge, is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, the video, and that's what I was talking about with ethnic studies, you know. The folks behind that movie and who were actually teachers shown in that film, you know, are really part of the vanguard for ethnic studies. That's a very important film and a very important movement.
Yeah, I can't wait to learn more about it and like hopefully take some of the lessons from that into like our own teaching and like build some more solidarity. So it'll be great. But yeah, thank you so much. And to all our listeners, please stay tuned. More episodes are coming. And bye to both of you. See you later. Bye.
All right.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
Very much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dose of dirty cold to go, been cold since cold flow. Got a wire to enlarge and I set a fire down below. I hang it up when you say sorry, didn't know. Probably got a year, 10 to go, so let's go. I don't really know how to go slow.